Hello, good evening, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'll be your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. And as our country and our communities are dealing with an overwhelming healthcare concern right now, our topic tonight will be the COVID-19 pandemic. We will be utilizing our time on Health Matters here to bring you information from physicians in our local area and other healthcare professionals to discuss how this novel coronavirus is impacting our local economy as well as our local healthcare. Tonight, I have joining us this evening Dr. Joseph Bocchini. He is an infectious disease specialist here in Shreveport with the Willis-Knighton Health System, and he will be sharing his knowledge of the coronavirus and its impact on our community with us tonight. Also joining me in the studio is Dr. Shelley Visconti, a local psychologist who is also one of our hosts here on Health Matters, and she will be helping us to address some of the mental health aspects associated with this pandemic. Let's go ahead and welcome Dr. Joseph Bocchini. Dr. Bocchini, are you with us? He's joining us via phone tonight.
Yes. Hey, Randall. I'm here.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Shelley, welcome. Thank you for being with us here on Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Dr. Bocchini, if you will, please, sir, just give us a little bit of summary of from the infectious disease standpoint, where we've been and where we are today with the coronavirus, in particular, you know, Caddo Parish, Shreveport, as well as an overview of where we are nationwide.
Well, you may be aware that today the number of positive cases that we've accumulated within the United States has now become greater than the total number of cases reported from China, where this pandemic began. So we have widespread activity across the United States of this COVID-19 virus. And in particular, we have a significant amount of activity within the state of Louisiana, more so in South Louisiana, but as you indicated, we also have cases here in Northwest Louisiana. This virus, as you know, began in Wuhan, China, spread very rapidly within that area, got to the United States, and now we are seeing significant activity throughout this country. The virus is a coronavirus that is novel. It's really a coronavirus that is related to the SARS and MERS coronaviruses that caused outbreaks in within the past 10 years. Only this one seems to have the ability to spread more efficiently, and as the others were controlled effectively and are no longer major problems, but this one has the ability not only to spread but produce severe disease. The problem with it, of course, is that with large numbers of individuals who are susceptible and a virus that spreads very rapidly, we're seeing a large number of cases, which results in a number of people sick enough to need to be in the hospital.
Thank you so much for that overview. From the standpoint of the number of cases in Caddo and Bossier Parish, I understand the number in the total state is nearly 1,800 now, with over 60 deaths reported. What does our local region look like, Caddo and Bossier Parishes? Obviously, our listening area covers most of all of Northwest Louisiana, some of Central Louisiana, East Texas, as well as Southern Arkansas. I don't know if you have access to those numbers as well, but in particular, what does the per capita rate look like here in these more rural areas compared to some of the more populated areas? Should be obviously be worried as much as they are, say, in New Orleans or other more populated areas?
Well, I think the more populated areas obviously have a greater opportunity for interaction with larger numbers of individuals in stores and other places where people come together for a variety of activities, so their chance for spread would potentially be higher. However, as of today, 53 out of 64 Louisiana parishes have had at least one case of coronavirus infection. And in addition to that, overall within the state, our per capita rate of infection is very high and may be one of the highest in the country. In part, that's because of the high attack rate so far in the New Orleans and Jefferson Parish area. So if we look at Caddo, as of today, there are 115 identified cases. In Bossier, there are 32 identified cases. If we go back to, for Jefferson Parish, it's 458 cases. In Orleans, it's 997. So you can see that the population density there has significant number of cases. We have fewer, but we're beginning to recognize that the rate of increase on a daily basis is significant enough to know that we have significant circulation of the virus within our area.
Do you know if our slope, the slope of the curve, the new in numbers of cases per day, if it matches New Orleans or if it's steeper or flatter?
I can't really say. We're in an earlier phase of increase, of daily increase, than New Orleans is, and we seem to parallel what was being seen in the New Orleans area maybe a week and a half or 2 weeks ago.
So we're basically a week or so behind New Orleans. So there's, I guess there's a lot of questions now in particular, you know, with some of the news suggesting that places that don't have as high of a case rate may not need to practice the same level of, stay-at-home vigilance with regards to social distancing as areas that have higher population densities. I think people would like to hear from you about, you know, do you think the governor's orders for stay-at-home for the entire state are appropriate, or as you may know, in other states, let's say, for example, Tennessee, stay-at-home really only applies to higher-density areas such as Memphis and Nashville. Could you speak to that in terms of the governor's order?
Well, I would say at this point, I think the governor's order is very appropriate in Louisiana. I think the per capita rate of infection that we're seeing is high enough to suggest that everybody, no matter whether you're in a higher density area or a lower density area, is at risk for acquiring this infection. And remember, one of the problems we have with this infection is that a significant portion of those who are infected never develop symptoms. And yet we do know that a percentage of them are going to shed the virus and potentially infect other individuals. We also know that those who have mild infections are generally going to be younger and healthy, whereas individuals who have more severe infections and potentially a severe enough infection to be hospitalized and require intensive care unit care are going to be older, over 60. They're going to have underlying health issues like diabetes, heart disease, lung disease. And we're beginning to learn that patients with immune deficiencies and other chronic medical problems may also be at increased risk for problems. It means that what we want to do is slow the spread of this virus in whatever size community that exists, because people are going to be interacting with each other in every community, whether it's a large one or a small one, potentially in meetings, at grocery stores, other places where people need to be close together to interact. Schools would be another example. Other venues where people would be together. So at this point, I think the governor's recommendation for the guidance from the public health people for strong social mitigation efforts, including everybody within the state, is very appropriate.
You know, one of the questions I have here to ask you is that, you know, young people are getting the message that it's not that bad of a disease in young people, and maybe they don't need to follow the guidelines. It's still okay to, especially, you know, the kids who are not in school, they want to go and spend time with their friends in the neighborhood. I mean, social distancing is extremely challenging amongst young people of just about any age. I guess, you know, I'm sort of asking a loaded question, given that you've already told me that and told everyone else that asymptomatic people can carry the virus and shed the virus. If you could just reiterate, how important is it for young people to follow the governor's orders as well?
It's extremely important. So this is not a time for adolescents, young adults to get together just because they're out of school, because if they transmit this infection amongst that population group, all of them have older relatives, they have family members who meet the demographic categories of having an underlying health condition that would increase their risk of severe disease. So even though younger individuals may not have the highest risk for serious disease, and we are now learning that some young individuals will have serious infection, some of them will end up hospitalized with severe lung disease. So it's not completely benign for them, although the risk of a serious infection is relatively low. But they will bring that infection to their parents, to their grandparents, to aunts, uncles, others that may have underlying conditions that put them at risk for severe disease. In addition, they're helping continue the spread of this virus within the community. And our goal is to prevent that spread by preventing social contact, so we can sort of get to the top of this epidemic curve and begin to slow down the spread of this infection so that we can protect more people in the long run.
Thank you so much for that important information. I'm going to remind our listeners, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Randall Brewer, and our topic is the COVID-19 pandemic caused by the novel coronavirus. Our guest tonight, Dr. Joseph Bocchini, head of infectious disease with the Willis-Knighton Health System, as well as Dr. Shelley Visconti, psychologist and also a Health Matters host as well. I'm going to give Dr. Bocchini a little bit of a break, and let's turn to the mental health aspects of COVID-19. Although this virus, as we understand it now, doesn't infect the brain, Shelley, I'm guessing that there's still some significant anxiety and psychological and or psychiatric issues that can be associated with what this virus is presenting to the community and the nation and the world.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is a frightening thing. This is something that is potentially harmful to us that we can't see, we can't taste, we can't feel. And so how do we maintain control of our health and our safety? It's a really difficult dilemma. Fortunately, there are things we can do, and there are ways to keep all of this in perspective, to manage our anxiety, to manage our depression, because we are having to isolate more. It can be depressing. And then also, if folks out there have underlying post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety or depression, panic disorder, OCD, something like this can cause those underlying disorders to worsen, or maybe if they have those disorders have gotten better, maybe come back. So there are lots of people really struggling with what's going on psychologically.
You know, one of the things that happens with social distancing, especially the more vulnerable populations, people who are elderly, you know, is the issue of loneliness, which is also well documented as an issue. You know, older people who are homebound or not able to get out more and have social interactions, it actually has a negative effect on their health, correct?
Yes, yes. You know, social interactions, we are social beings. Even those of us who are tend to be introverted, we're still social. And so we crave social interactions. And without those, it really has a negative impact on our well-being, our outlook on life, and also our health.
So I guess one of the things that we've seen happening quite frequently is the ability to be social with distancing in place. What are some of the things that people can do to be social but maintain that social distancing parameter of 6 feet or even more?
So thankfully, we have fantastic technologies now that can help us to interact and connect with others in a safe manner. So, for instance, with my patients, the way that we are staying in touch is on the phone, over the internet. My friends and family, we are keeping in touch, you know, again, over the phone, through the internet. I encourage people, you know, you can get incredibly creative. You can play card games. You can chat. You can just turn it on and go about your day and check in with each other periodically. Just having someone to check in with and keeping that dialogue open, you know, can really help to lift your spirits and can help you feel like you're not so alone and quite so isolated.
So maintain the contact, but ensure the physical distance as well.
Yes.
Use technology to our advantage.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, there have been great videos that we've seen of people visiting through windows, visiting, you know, porch concerts, and just different things like that. And I think that this is a great time to use our creativity to maintain those relationships and maintain that contact, but in a way that is safe.
And in addition to loneliness, another issue that I think, you know, comes to mind is that of economic anxiety. What's going to happen in the future? Are we going to have a recession? Are we going to have a depression? You know, maybe families are dealing with a job loss or being laid off. What are some of the things that people can do out there? Let's say they are social distancing. They're not necessarily worried about the direct effects of the virus, but have this looming economic anxiety.
Sure. You know, a huge stressor for people is, you know, am I going to be able to pay my bills? And that's a real question for a lot of folks out there right now. So trying to do things like limit the amount of time that you are spending poring over those bills. You know, keep an eye on your finances, but try not to just let it completely consume your mind and your time. Same with news coverage and reading newspapers and things like that. You know, limit the amount of time that you are spending exposing yourself to this information. Stay informed, stay updated so that you can stay safe, but do not allow it to consume you. Because there is that, you can with all the information that we are bombarded by, it can be all-consuming. You really need to take a break from all the worries that we can trouble ourselves with by staying active, exercising, stretching. You know, a lot of times people don't realize how tense we can get. Stretching is a wonderful thing to do. Meditating. If you don't know how to meditate, learn to meditate. We've got time now to learn to do those things. Deep breathing. There are lots of fabulous websites that can teach you how to learn some really great deep breathing techniques, meditation. Amazon Prime has different things that you can listen to, waves and different soothing sounds. You know, turn those types of things on. YouTube has great meditation videos. Every kind of meditation you can possibly think of, you can find on YouTube. So now that we have time, you know, spend it on the internet instead of looking at additional news about death tolls and things like that. Spend some time researching how to meditate, how to relax, how to cope and deal with the anxiety.
And one of the things that you mentioned, disconnecting from the news cycle, because it's really consumed the news cycle, the coronavirus, and you know, maybe disconnecting from technology, getting outside, walking the dog, getting with pets, and being out in, you know, in nature potentially can help as well, right?
Absolutely. Sunlight is a wonderful thing. I mean, it will improve your mood. It will improve your health. I mean, sunlight safely. We don't want to go out and bake ourselves. But getting out and exposing yourself to some sunlight, some air, and exercising is going to be a great way to improve your mood. And go out and practice what we call mindfulness. Take a walk and really look around at all of the beautiful things that surround us. Really inspect that leaf. Really look at that flower. Really enjoy the nature and take it in. And now's a great time to do it because the streets aren't as crowded. So you can enjoy some peace and quiet.
Yeah, it's sad to see, but you see people sort of taking a leisurely stroll in an empty Times Square or an empty mm-hmm. street in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's harrowing. Dr. Bocchini, are you still there with us, sir?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much again for joining us. I'm going to remind our listeners, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. If you happen to have a question or comment about this topic, which is COVID-19 or the coronavirus, you can call us at 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Bocchini, from the standpoint of, you know, what's going to happen next with this virus? One of the questions that we had that came in was, you mentioned how contagious it is and how efficient it is in terms of spread. You know, should we give up? Is there any way to avoid getting this virus? Is this something that we're all eventually going to have to deal with?
Well, it certainly is possible that we all will eventually become infected with this virus. But the important thing is the fewer people that get infected now, the less likely we're going to have our health systems overwhelmed. So number one, it's really important to reduce the rate of spread of this infection so that we can adequately treat the patients who will need support from our medical community, both on an outpatient basis, within the hospital, and in our intensive care units. Number two, if we delay infections for individuals, we have an opportunity in those people who are infected to test possible therapies that might modify the course of the infection and change the survival rate, change the severity of the infection. So we do need time to test a variety of different potential therapies. Number three, we're actively working for a vaccine. And if we can develop a vaccine within the year and a half that it might take to do that, then we can even protect more people by having those people who are not infected be protected by the vaccine before they become infected. So there are many reasons why we want to protect people from getting infected now. In addition, by doing this, we then reduce the risk of exposure to the highest risk populations.
One of the questions that we have was, you know, is there the possibility, I think Dr. Fauci may have addressed this recently, but I wanted to make sure we addressed it here with our community. Is it possible that this is not going to be a seasonal virus or sort of a one-hit wonder type of phenomenon that maybe SARS or MERS were, and that this is going to be a recurrent issue like the flu?
Yes, I think Dr. Fauci's summary of that was very appropriate. We don't know what this virus will ultimately do, but there is a high likelihood that this virus is going to begin to circulate like many respiratory viruses do, so that as the weather warms and there's decreased spread of this virus in the northern hemisphere, as the weather cools in the southern hemisphere, they begin their winter, we may see more outbreaks in the southern hemisphere, and then the next winter, we see the virus up here again. So there is a very significant possibility that this virus is so well established within the population that we will continue to see it circulate on a regular basis, just like influenza does and other respiratory viruses.
Do we have any indication that warmer ambient temperatures are going to help us to clear the virus faster with you know, the weather getting warmer, temperatures climbing into the 80s, will that have any beneficial effect on the virus? Is it hardy in warmer weather, or is that just something that's a rumor?
Well, the coronaviruses in general spread more readily during colder, drier winter seasons. This virus is new enough that we can't say that yet. We do know that in places such as Florida, where the weather's already warm, we're seeing cases. So we won't completely, I think, see a clearance of infections during the summer months, but we may see a significant slowdown of viral spreading because the environment might not be as conducive for viral spread for this agent. So, yes, it's very possible that summertime, warmer weather, change in humidity is going to reduce the likelihood of spread from person to person. But since it's a novel virus, we don't really know how much weather is going to affect it. Again, if it becomes well established in the population, it will not need to spread very effectively in the summer to remain prevalent in the population so that it can come back again when the weather is more conducive to its survival and spread.
So, I mean, that's an important point that you raised. So if we ease up social distancing as it's getting warmer and we're tired of, you know, staying at home, and we starting to flatten the curve, is there a risk if we get out there and get together here in the early parts of the summer that it spikes again?
Yes, that's entirely possible. And that's why it's going to be very important to listen to public health authorities like Dr. Fauci and others that will to help us understand, as the curve changes, when it would become safe for us to resume some or most of or all of our activities at such a time when we don't risk the virus coming back because we haven't waited long enough to clear the likelihood of infection.
Let's go ahead and take a call from a caller from Natchitoches. Thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you. My wife has recently, just today, discovered that she had a conversation with someone earlier today who has tested positive for the virus. And we're trying to decide whether I should come home, or how do you live with someone who may have been exposed to, what precautions should you take if you live in the same household with someone who either tests positive or has been exposed to someone who tests positive?
And the person who was positive for the virus, was that individual symptomatic? With a cough, fever, sore throat, things along those lines? Or were they?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know that.
Okay, let's see what Dr. Bocchini says.
So as Dr. Brewer indicated, I think one of the things that's important to know would be whether the person was symptomatic or not symptomatic, how long
okay.
It was from the time that your wife was in front of this person to when the person became symptomatic or when the decision was made to test the person. Because if your wife was in contact with this person for more than 5 days before the person became symptomatic, she might have a much lower risk than if she was in contact when the person was actively in coughing and sneezing. Number two, it's going to be really important to define how close she was to this person, how long she was with this person, to determine the likelihood that she may have been infected. So I think she needs to be talking to her physician to understand what her risk would be, to then determine what the next steps would be. If it was thought that she had a significant risk of acquiring the infection, then the best thing for her to do is to isolate herself at home. The incubation period after exposure is 14 days. So what we're saying is if someone is exposed, a known exposure that would increase the risk for acquiring the virus, that the person should self-isolate themselves at home for 14 days, keep in contact with their physician so that if they develop symptoms, they want to call their physician to help understand what next steps would be. If they end up with a mild viral-like respiratory illness with no underlying risk factors that would be of concern to the physician, they might want her just to stay at home, ride through the infection, look for symptoms that would cause alarm for them to then come and see the physician for evaluation for possible treatment. Number two, if they're in the household, then the question is, what do we do about the people around them? And that's one of the questions that you asked. And what would you do if your wife was at a high risk based on exposure? Then what we would want to have happen is for her to sort of self-isolate herself to the best degree possible within that household from other people. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has a very nice website that talks about how to distance yourself in a household from someone who may have been exposed to and might be incubating the COVID-19 virus. So you could use that to help you. If you have a separate bedroom, separate bathroom, separate facilities, if you do careful, proper hand washing and other things, you might be able to prevent the infection from being transmitted in the household. What we know is if you don't take those precautions, from data from China, is that family spread is very common, and perhaps up to 80% of family members could become infected if we don't take efforts or do things to try and mitigate the spread.
Well, thank you so much.
Bill, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight. Again, this is listener-supported Red River Radio. You're listening to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host tonight. We are discussing the coronavirus epidemic, known the disease known as COVID-19. Our guests tonight are Dr. Shelley Visconti, psychologist here in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Joseph Bocchini, infectious disease expert, now with the Willis-Knighton Health System. If you have a question or comment about this topic, you can call us at 1-800-552-8502. Shelley, as Dr. Bocchini recommended, you know, self-isolation is important. And families are finding themselves together quite a bit right now. Do you have, and that introduces its own stress with regards to both overexposure, as well as, you know, parents are finding themselves homeschooling. Now, if the school program is moved online, parents need to supervise the children in that. Some of these families don't have experience with that. What advice would you give some of the families who are dealing with some of those issues that come with what we're facing?
Sure. Time with family can be wonderful, and then it can be not wonderful. So, you know, I would recommend trying to maintain as much structure, both for the adults and the children. It's going to be particularly important for the children, but also it's important for the adults. Try to maintain those times that you typically would get up and go to bed. Try to maintain routines as far as times that you eat dinner. Try to, if you are homeschooling, try to have a specific spot in the home where school supplies are kept, where the studying takes place, so that it's almost as if the children are going to school, even though it's within the home, still there is a spot. So almost like someone who works from home and has a home office. Sometimes that can be helpful to maintain that routine and that sense of normalcy. You know, as things, as disagreements come up, talking about them, not letting things fester, not letting things get too far, going ahead and airing those grievances as best you can, and talking them out and seeing what kind of accommodations can be made. And if you need a break, go outside, take a break. You know, there's nothing wrong with adults taking a time out. When things start getting a little too heated, walk away, take a few minutes, and then, you know, decide if we can come back in and discuss whatever's going on. And if we can't yet, then we take another 5 minutes. This is going to be a really trying time. It's going to be really difficult because it's change, and adapting to change is really difficult for us. So my first recommendation would be, you know, that structure. Maintaining that structure is going to be really helpful.
And perhaps maybe structured outside physical activity.
Yes.
Just like the PE class.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Dr. Bocchini, a question that that we have that's coming up with regards to treatment. Obviously, the respiratory system is the one that's most severely affected in the more severe cases. One questioner is asking, what's the difference? We hear about shortages in equipment. What's the difference between a respirator and a ventilator?
That's a good question.
I think they're using them synonymously, don't you?
I think so. I think it's the same thing. We need a pulmonologist or a respiratory therapist to help us define that better. But these are machines that assist the patients whose lungs have reached a point where on their own they cannot maintain enough oxygenation for the patient to maintain the oxygen level that's necessary to support organ function. So this will require the placement of what's called an endotracheal tube or some other tube to enable attachment to the machine so that the machine can take over the breathing for the patient and enable better oxygenation.
Yeah, I think one of the issues might be, you know, with regards to occupational hazards with people using complicated respirators that are similar to maybe, you know, diving and altitude and things along those lines. Maybe pilots use and divers use and occupational issues. But our doctors and nurses, they're not using any specialized equipment with regards to that, correct? They're using what's called the N95 mask for protection,
yes.
Correct?
So there is a respirator mask, and that is the N95. And the advantage of the N95, it's made up of material that will prevent the transmission of the virus, because the size of the pores that you breathe through is small enough to reduce the likelihood of virus entering through the mask. And that's why it's a much better mask when you're facing a situation where there may be significant amount of virus up in the air to reduce you breathing in that virus. A surgical mask provides some protection, but not as significant as the N95. And the N95 is the name 95 because it reduces 95% of the transmission of the agent through the mask.
Another question regarding masks that just came in. A listener is asking, if they work in retail, should they be wearing a respirator type of mask or a mask at all?
So the current recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control is that individuals who are not sick and out in the community do not need to wear masks. One of the problems with wearing a mask for a long time when you're out doing regular activities is that it becomes uncomfortable. You put your hand on it to straighten it out, to fix it. It gets moist from your respirations, and therefore it potentially increases your risk of transmitting the virus just through the normal activities of trying to maintain the mask. So the better thing to do if you're in retail is make sure that you keep the 6-foot distance from others that you interact with. The virus with a cough or a sneeze typically will only go 4 to 6 feet in front of that individual. So if you maintain a 6-foot distance, you are going to reduce the likelihood of spread of that virus to you. In addition, any surface that you work on potentially can become contaminated by the virus as it falls from the air onto that surface, and it may survive on that surface for a period of time depending on what the surface is and what the characteristics of the environment are. So you want to make sure that you are cleaning off the surfaces that you work on with appropriate wipes to reduce the viability of any virus that might be on there and decontaminate it. And then third, because you're going to interact with people and have credit cards or other things in your hands, then there's a real chance that your hands will become contaminated. So you do frequent hand washing or frequent use of alcohol gel, and you do your best not to touch your hands to your face.
Excellent. Let's go to our next question from Mark from Oakdale. Mark, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
It's kind of a two-part question. I'm actually a trucker on the road, but as far as I know, the research is still in the research stage. People with sinus issues or anything like sinus related, has that impacted, or does he have any comments on people with sinus issues?
All right, great question, Dr. Bocchini. Any information from those out there? It's allergy season, by the way. As if there's any other health problems in the country, there's a lot of regular flu and colds and viruses that circulate in addition to this problem. But chronic sinusitis or people with allergies, should they take any special precautions?
So it's hard to know because we don't have enough data that would give us the evidence that's needed to know whether people with chronic sinus infection or sinusitis would be at increased risk for a worse viral infection, more serious viral infection, greater growth of the virus within those inflamed tissues. So my suggestion would be that anybody with any chronic symptoms, just be careful the way we want everybody to be to reduce the likelihood of transmission. If you have chronic sinus infection symptoms, if you have asthma, if you have other respiratory chronic illnesses, the most important thing you could do at this point would be to try and control your chronic symptoms by following your physician's recommendations for clearing those sinuses, treating your asthma, make sure that you have it under good control so that if you do encounter the virus, you're less likely to potentially have complications.
Thank you so much for that answer. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight is the COVID-19 illness caused by the novel coronavirus. We have Dr. Joseph Bocchini, infectious disease specialist with the Willis-Knighton Health System, as well as Shelley Visconti, psychologist here in Shreveport. Shelley, from the standpoint of the psychological issues that have to do with situations with severe illness and pandemics. We talked about loneliness, we talked about depression, we talked about anxiety going forward. From your standpoint, what would you recommend to people who have a family member who has gotten ill and they're having difficulty coping? Because as you may know, we can't see our family members that are in the hospital that are isolated with this illness. How are families maintaining contact and continuity with when illnesses happen and they can't, see them in the hospital? It's tragic.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak about this from experience. I was hospitalized for a different reason just about a little over a week ago, and my husband could not come and see me, and it was really, really difficult for both of us. And what we did is we stayed on our cell phones. We sent texts, we sent videos, would call each other, and that was really helpful in managing anxiety in both of us and helping to lift my spirits, and then also managing his anxiety, just wondering how I'm doing. So it is really difficult dealing with illness, but especially if you have a loved one that you aren't able to check on them. So if you are able to Have someone there at the hospital that has your phone number, a worker that can check in with you periodically. You know, that would be really helpful. Although, you know, a lot of our medical personnel are already stretched to the max. But trying to also keep things in perspective. There are deaths related with this. However, the likelihood is that your loved one will survive, and it may be a horrible, difficult experience, but the likelihood is that everybody will make it out just fine. And so I think that trying to maintain perspective and getting that support, that social support from other loved ones, and also not being afraid to reach out to mental health professionals. We are still working. I am still seeing patients every day. I see them by phone and online. But, you know, if you need support, reaching out and getting that support, because this is a really difficult time.
You know, there's another set of individuals that we need to thank publicly in a large way on the air, but also, you know, maybe offer them some advice with regards to anxiety, and those are our healthcare providers, emergency room nurses and doctors, respiratory therapists, intensive care unit nurses and doctors and respiratory therapists, desk clerks, everybody that's connected to this pandemic. How would you make recommendations to them in terms of their anxiety? I read stories where people are, you know, they're showering and changing all their clothes and still isolating from home because they don't want to bring this stuff home.
Yeah, sure. I mean, as I said before, you know, this is an invisible thing that it's so it makes us feel so helpless, because how can we control it? I mean, that's why people are buying so much toilet paper. You know, we're trying to maintain a sense of control. But you know, supporting one another within the medical community, having little debriefings with each other, the people that are experiencing the same kind of anxieties that you are, you know, opening up about those and discussing those and being honest about those, you know, not being strong and silent. And also to those of us who are not in the medical community, thanking those who are in the medical community, making sure that we send a little note or a little text or a card or whatever that we can do to let them know that we are thinking of them. It does make a difference. It does lift people's spirits if they know that they are working and people are supporting them. And also healthcare professionals, you know, just making sure as best you can, because it's difficult to get enough sleep, to eat properly, to take care of yourself so that your immune system is healthy. And it's really difficult to do those things in this time, but just trying to do all those things to maintain your health will also help to maintain your psychological well-being.
I think in your field, don't they call that trauma bonding? If you're bonding with individuals in a high stress situation, that can become very therapeutic.
Yes, you know, having other people who are going through the same thing. I mean, that's, you know, what we do in group therapy, whether it be for post-traumatic stress disorder or rape or domestic violence or whatever. Having other people that are going through the exact same thing, who are willing to honestly and openly talk about their feelings, so that you know that other people are feeling the same thing, so that you know that it's not just you. It's so therapeutic and so helpful.
Because it's very traumatic, even though the risk may not be, you know, extremely high, just the threat.
Yeah, the potential is there.
Can be just as damaging as having a real risk.
Sure. I mean, to meet criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, there has to be a potential threat. It doesn't have to be an actual threat, a potential threat.
And that can be worse than an actual threat because the fear of the unknown is there.
Sure.
Dr. Bocchini, in the little bit of time that we have left, I know we don't have an FDA-approved treatment for the coronavirus, but if you could please summarize for our listeners, you know, what the pharmacotherapy actually looks like right now as it stands today, and then maybe what it could look like in the coming weeks and months to treat the virus.
Well, as you said, at this point, there are no FDA-approved therapies for this coronavirus. On the other hand, there are a number of ways that people are looking at to try and provide some therapeutic benefit against this viral infection. But none of these are proven, and some may have potential, but we really don't know where they're going to fit. So the first thing would be drugs that we already have on the market for other uses that potentially might have an effect on this virus, may modify the course of the infection. And the first one that everybody's been talking about is a drug that we've used for malaria treatment for many years called chloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine is another partner drug to that one that is now being used as an anti-inflammatory drug for treatment of lupus and other collagen vascular autoimmune disorders. There is limited, as Dr. Fauci said, anecdotal data, which means that people have tried this drug in some patients with the infection and felt that it may have made them better more quickly. The problem with that is that we need a controlled trial to know whether this is an effective therapy. And the reason we need a controlled trial is, as Shelley said, most of the people who have this infection are going to get better. And even those that are hospitalized, the vast majority will get better. So when you have a drug that you give to a small number of patients and they all get better, you don't know whether that would have been the natural course of the infection in those individuals or whether that's drug effect. So we need controlled clinical trials of this drug to make sure that it's true that it has some effect. And there are development of clinical trials in adults primarily and will be undertaken in New York very shortly, if they haven't started already, to look at potential effectiveness of this drug. In addition, there are antiviral therapies. One drug called Remdesivir is a antiviral drug that in the laboratory looks like it can effectively kill coronaviruses or reduce their replication. So this is another drug that's beginning to undergo clinical trials to determine whether it would be effective against this this infection. So we do. There are other antiviral drugs. One that's an anti-HIV antiviral combination drug that we've used for a number of years that may also potentially have some effectiveness. So that is going to be looked at as well. In addition, people are looking at using what's called plasma therapy, taking blood from people who have survived the coronavirus infection, where they have developed a strong antibody response, purifying the antibodies, and then giving what we call gamma globulin injection to attempt to modify the course of the viral infection. So that's another potential approach to therapy that will be tried. So that's just a feel for what we have that may be applicable in the future, but it's going to take a number of months to prove whether those drugs are effective or not. And then there's some other antivirals as well. The most important thing would be development of a safe and effective vaccine, which would protect people from even getting infected. And as I mentioned earlier, that may take a year to 18 months if all of the work that has to be done to make that, make that available goes in just the way it should, without any complications that would have to make you backtrack the review and then redo the process.
From the standpoint of not also treatment, but to back up just a little bit, I know testing has really been quite an issue with this particular disease process. Could you just summarize for our listeners what the status of testing is now, as well as a follow-up to your comment regarding convalescent plasma, also serologic testing, is that going to be available?
Well, serologic testing probably has some months to go before it would become available for routine use. But as far as testing is concerned, testing is really important because we're in the first part of the strategy to control this infection was really to prevent it from getting here. And that was really just to slow down the process so we could better prepare. Testing becomes really important because now we're in the mitigation phase of the control of this viral infection. We need testing to identify all of the patients who are infected so that we can make sure that they are in isolation to prevent them from spreading this through routine activities to other individuals. That phase is called containment, where we're trying to really control the spread of the virus as effectively as we can to change the course of this epidemic curve. We don't have enough testing at the present time for the containment strategy. We've had significant improvement in availability of testing within the past 2 weeks that has made it easier to get a test and get a result in a timely fashion so that you can identify the patients who are infected. And then also it's really important because while we're waiting for a test result on a hospitalized patient, we have to use all the personal protective equipment that we would if the patient's positive until we know the patient's negative. So the longer we have to wait for a test result, the more of that personal protective equipment we need to use. And so faster turnaround is important. When we first started testing, it would take up to 7 or 8 days to get the results. We're now getting results within 48 hours. The hope is that within the very near future, our local hospitals, some of them will be able to take on testing within our own institutions. If that happens, we're going to change the turnaround time to just 4 to 6 hours, so we'll have same-day results. So testing is improving. We're not there yet with what we need to really start the third phase of the control of this infection.
What is the status of the almost very simple test that is available for review in 45 minutes that we hear about on the news?
I can't tell you the exact status of that. I think that becomes almost a point-of-care test, which would be really helpful, and it would also shorten the time with which we need to make decisions about individual patients. Again, I don't know the current status of that. Hopefully that would get through FDA clearance rather quickly, and once cleared, we obviously need to have a buildup of available tests so that they can be distributed to the sites that need them.
Well, Dr. Bocchini, it's been a real pleasure and honor to speak with you tonight on Health Matters. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Randall. It's a pleasure for me to be here. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks also to Dr. Shelley Visconti, a psychologist here in Shreveport, also the host of Mental Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I would also like to thank all of the healthcare providers out there that keep us safe every day, from the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the doctors, the healthcare administrators, everyone that is helping us to fight this pandemic. We really, really appreciate your efforts that you put out there every day. I'd also like to thank the Noel Foundation for their assistance with sponsoring Red River Radio. The producer of Health Matters is Renee Moran. Also helping us tonight were Mr. Kermit Poling, Wally Derleth, as well as Mr. Troy Jones. The views and expressed here on Health Matters tonight may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its staff. Please tune in with us again next week as we will bring you another update on the COVID-19 pandemic here in our area. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for listening this evening. This is 89.9 FM KDAQ Shreveport Bossier City, 90.7 FM KLSA Alexandria Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, 88.9 FM KLDN Lufkin, Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK, Overton, Tyler, Kilgore. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.